Date and time, Tuesday, January 15th, 2 p.m. for the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission. We are in the State Capitol Building in room 468 in Pierce, South Dakota. I am Gary Hansen, Chairman, and with me is Vice Chairman Dusty Johnson and Commissioner Steve Kolbeck. On the agenda today, the first item we have is administration. And is there a motion to approve the minutes of the commission meetings that were held on October 23rd and November 20th of 2007?
Second.
There's been a motion without any discussion being seen. All those in favor, please signify by saying yes. Commissioner Kolbeck?
Aye. Yes.
Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
Commissioner Hansen votes aye. Administration, the minutes have carried and have been approved. Consumer reports. Status report on consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the Commission. Consumer Affairs, Deb Gregg.
Thank you, Chairman Hansen. The Commission has received a total of 146 contacts since the last report was prepared for the December 18th, 2007 Commission meeting. 30 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 27 contacts involved electric services, 15 contacts involved natural gas services, 19 contacts involved cell phone service, 29 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, 3 contacts were related to wind energy, and 23 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 56 of the 73 contacts received in 2008 have been resolved, and 2,249 of the 2,337 complaints received in 2007 have been resolved.
Thank you, Deb. Would you mind repeating that just one more time? How many have been resolved of how many last year?
Last year, 2,249 of the 2,337 complaints have been resolved. 2007.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of Ms. Gregg? Seeing none, we'll move on to the agenda on natural gas, NG07-022, in the matter of the filing by Mid-American Energy Company for approval of tariff revisions. Question before the commission is, shall the commission approve the tariff revisions? Who will be handling this for?
Chairman,
we should go to the applicant first, Mid-American.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and commissioners, my name is Jean Callaghan. I'm representing Mid-American Energy today. Gary Myers is also available to answer any questions. He's our distribution engineer supervisor. I filed a revision to the Mid-American gas tariffs and removed tariff language which explained how a residential customer could request Mid-American to install an excess flow valve, and the customer then would be responsible to pay for the installation and the maintenance thereafter. In compliance with some federal rule changes, Mid-American will be installing this excess flow valve for single-family residential dwellings that have gas pressure operating at an average continual flow of 10 pounds pressure per square inch gauge. With this installation, Mid-American will be responsible for both the installation cost and the maintenance. The installation will then be part of their normal construction standards, and Mid-American is requesting this change also in all its jurisdictions. I am taking the language out of our tariff since it is part of our, will be part of our normal construction standards, and we would like to have this approved effective January 31st. If you have any questions, I'm sure Gary and I would be happy to answer those now.
Thank you, Ms. Callaghan. We'll wait with our questions unless some of the commissioners have one at this juncture, and we'll go to Mr. Jacobs, are you handling this?
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, this filing, I think Gene did a good job of going over it. I did talk with Nathan Solem here at staff, and he said that the federal regulation is forthcoming and will take effect. So he recommended approval. And besides that, he thought it's just a good practice to have this a regular procedure to install these on all new new hookups and re-engineered locations too.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions by commissioners? Commissioner Johnson.
Could somebody, you know, either Ms. Callaghan or Mr. Jacobson, tell me what is an excess flow valve? It seems like those three words are pretty easy, and I should be able to figure it out on my own. But what is its purpose? Why has it not been standard, you know, heretofore? Just a little background.
And Commissioner Johnson, could I have Gary Myers, our engineer, explain that?
Sure. Hop in, Gary. The water's fine.
All right. Excess flow valves are, the new ones are usually installed in a plastic service line for residential customers, service lines that serve a single residential customer, not where you have maybe multiple apartment buildings, those type of setups. What they're intended to do is when installed at the connection where the service ties to our distribution main, typically out by the street or back of curb, they're to try to help prevent an excess flow amount of gas from leaving the service if that service is damaged. They're not meant to prevent damage that would be subsequent to a gas leak from inside piping or a small hole in the service line between the main and the house. It's meant primarily for third-party damage. If a backhoe comes and cuts the service line in half, it would sense that the flow going through that service line is greater than what the service line normally is designed for, and it would shut it off except for a small amount of bypass gas that once the service is repaired, the bypass gas would fill the downstream piping and then open it back up so it doesn't have to be dug up and reset. It's kind of a resetting valve. So it's primarily meant to be protecting the entire outside service line from usually third-party or other physical damage that would sever the line, not necessarily just be a small leak. Or if used on steel, it wouldn't necessarily trip in case of a corrosion leak or a problem, like I said earlier, with inside customer piping. The leak would have to be sufficient to be over the rated capacity of the relief valve, which has to be over the rated capacity of the meter set, or it would shut off unintentionally if a customer added a small amount of load or if it wasn't designed properly. So it's not meant to prevent all leaks. It's meant to prevent large gas flow, usually caused by third-party damage or a dig into the service line.
Thank you. That's a good question. Mr. Miners, this is somewhat like a ground fault circuit interrupter, an arc fault circuit interrupter in electricity then. I've always been concerned about running and shutting off the gas and water, et cetera, if there's, for instance, a tornado or something of that nature. Would this, in that type of a situation, if there was a considerable destruction and a gas leakage, is it likely that it would sense that sort of thing and turn off the gas to the property?
It depends on how it's sized. For example, say on a 10-pound, the lowest pressure we serve typically in Sioux Falls is a normal 10-pound operating system. If a tornado comes and tears the wall away from the meter set, if the damage is after the regulator is a device that cuts the pressure from, say, our 10-pound delivery system in our distribution system, say a quarter-pound or 7-inch water column to the customer. If the damage is after the meter set, usually the regulator would be the limiting factor there, so the excess flow valve would not take over.
Sure.
If the damage was prior to the regulator, where maybe the gas pipe comes out of the ground, it tore the whole meter set off, then that could be an example of where it would take over. One of the examples we had in Sioux Falls, you probably saw it in the media, where the car one evening drove into the corner of a house that actually broke off the riser that comes out of the ground. And in that case, it's questionable because it was a copper riser, which tends to crimp off a little bit as it's damaged, but that may be an instance where the excess flow valve would have taken over and reduced the flow to just that small bypass amount that once the repair is made, it would reset itself. So it would have to be something, a leak higher in capacity than what the service line and meter set are designed for. Otherwise, it would shut off unintentionally, say on a coldest day of the year, which would be the worst time.
Sure, understood.
So it would have to be a fairly large leak, and again, that's primarily designed to handle those excavation or third-party damage dig-ins.
How do you reset these?
They're normally supposed to reset by themselves. Obviously, anything in the system, if it did get some debris, I think they have a pretty good track record, at least the newer ones. They bleed by. There's a small port to bleed by a little bit of gas, so it controls it down to almost a trickle of gas. And then once the repair is made, it would bleed by that valve at a fairly low rate, but when the repair is made, it would fill the downstream side to equalize pressure with the upstream side, and then it would open itself. If there was debris in there, it could prevent that from happening, but most of the newer plastic systems really, we don't anticipate it happening. Those companies that have put it in haven't experienced a large number of those not resetting. Could apply natural gas pressure from the service riser that comes up by the house and try to reset it, or you'd have to dig it up and cut it out if it had debris in it that couldn't be fixed through just back pressuring or through the valve operating normally. And that was the concern initially with a lot of the companies that hadn't used them before, is where we have 3 or 4 or 5 foot of frost in the wintertime, and if it happened because a customer added significant load and it caused it to trip, if you had to dig it up, it's a lot more of a process than in the summertime when you don't have frost conditions.
Sure. Thank you much. Did you say how much these cost?
The item itself is about, I looked the price up yesterday, I think they're around $16 or $17 for the typical residential service. And then it requires an extra fusion and cooling time at the time of the installation. So, you know, our estimates are another 10 to 15 minutes of, you know, one or two people fusing that fitting onto the tap T close to the main, and then the service is fused onto the end of that. So the estimated price we had previously when some customers chose to have it installed was around $52.
Thank you. Appreciate the information. Are there any other questions?
The chairman?
Yes. Mr. Johnson.
Along that line of questioning, I talked to Jean Callaghan, and I think she got the information from Gary yesterday. How many of these, you know, obviously they were available before, and how many had been put into service before? She said that in the last year, she thought maybe 24 had been put into service. But under the new scenario, they think maybe 1,500 per year would be put in. So, and at $52, you can understand that the cost is, you know, over $75,000 for this. So.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes, I just have one for Gary. These check valves, or you have these, are they on every single line that you put in, or are we just talking about residential?
Right now, the requirement is for, there are certain criteria. The system can't droop below 10 pounds any time of the year. So, for example, on our 10-pound system in Sioux Falls, our minimum design pressure at the end of that system would be 5 pounds. When it gets below that, then we start designing additional system ties or additional pressure regulator stations to bring the pressure back up. So in that case, they would not be eligible. The literature on several of these manufacturers have a pressure range of 5 up to 125 pounds. The problem, if your inlet pressure is too low, they may trip under normal operating conditions because you just don't have enough differential pressure to work normally. So our stance is that the system pressure should not droop below 10 pounds. So an operating system that we're currently looking at is those systems operating normally at higher than 15 pounds, because those systems, we could expect on the end of those systems to drop to 7 pounds or in that range. And across the company, different engineers use different standards based on their systems. But on the west side of Iowa and in South Dakota, Dean Berger from Sioux City and myself are looking at those pressure systems of higher than 15 pounds normal operating pressure, single residential service lines, so you would not have branch or dual services or apartment complexes, and we would also not be installing them on commercial properties.
Okay, so this is just one area where EFVs were not used before that they're going to be used now, correct? That's what this tariff refers to?
Could you repeat the question? I missed part of that.
These would be installed on something that it was not previously installed on. Is that correct?
Well, before, the choice was given to the homeowner. So if we went into an area where they were eligible, so say on our 48-pound system, we would talk to the customer and ask, or the builder if it was a spec home, we would ask if they wanted the excess flow valve installed. And if they did, then, you know, it was the $52 charge, and any future maintenance due to the excess flow valve would be the customer's responsibility as well. And that's where David mentioned that in the past, and actually it's been over the last 5 or 6 years, we've only installed a couple dozen because customers have chosen. The new code, the DOT code coming out we're expecting mid-year, is going to require them. It's no longer going to be an option of the customer. It'll be required for those eligible services, which, again, would be normal systems operating at 15 pounds or higher for us, or higher than 15 pounds, single residential. They aren't demanding or requiring that they be put on commercials. So the application is almost the same as previous, but the requirement is that now we don't give the customer a choice. We as a company have to put them on those eligible services.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome.
Are there any further questions? Seeing none, is there a motion on NG07-022?
Mr. Chairman, I would move to approve the tariff revisions.
Are there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll call a vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying yes. Commissioner Kolbeck?
Yes.
Commissioner Johnson?
Aye.
And Hansen votes yes. We have motion carries. Telecommunications, item TC07-107, in the matter of the unauthorized long-distance changes and unauthorized telephone charges made by a reduced rate long distance. The question before the commission is, shall a commission grant intervention to Prairie Wave Black Hills LLC and to Prairie Wave Telecommunications Incorporated? The applicant is on the phone. Is there any request other than what we have before us?
This is Bill Heaston, Mr. Chairman, and no, sir, we don't have any additional requests.
Ms. Moore, do you have anything that you'd like to add for reduced rates, long distance?
There's no objection to the motion to intervene by Prairie Wave on behalf of reduced rates.
Thank you. The commission?
Staff would just recommend granting the intervention.
Thank you, Mr. Singer. Is there a motion or discussion?
I'll motion TC07-107 that the commission grant the intervention of Prairie Wave, Black Hills LLC, and Prairie Wave Telecommunications Incorporated.
Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, Commissioner Kolbeck?
Yes.
Commissioner Johnson?
Yes.
Hansen votes aye. Motion carries. In docket TC07-118, in the matter of filing by Prairie Wave Telecommunications Incorporated for exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates. On December 14, 2007, a petition for intervention was filed by AT&T Communications of the Midwest. The question before us is, shall a commission grant the petition for intervention to AT&T Communications of the Midwest? Good afternoon, Mr. Van Camp.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Bill Van Camp here on behalf of AT&T. We have nothing really to add other than our petition to intervene. We are an IXC providing services, and we are required to pay interstate switch access charges to customers of AT&T's that happen to use a specific local exchange carrier in state.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Mr. Van Camp at this time? Seeing none, is there anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of Prairie Wave Telecommunications?
Mr. Chairman, this is Bill Heaston on behalf of Prairie Wave, and I apologize to the commission and to Mr. Van Camp, but in reviewing the documents right before we got on this, I noticed that the motion to intervene is titled Prairie Wave Community Telephone, but it has the docket number for Prairie Wave Telecommunications, so I... I want to be sure we clear that ambiguity up, that this is telecommunications.
Do you have any objection to that, Mr. Heaston?
No, not to making sure the name on the top is right. And that's kind of why I didn't really look at this, because it said community telephone. And the issue I've got, though, is with telecommunications. And, again, I don't know, Bill, if you have had a chance in the last few months to review the settlement agreement between AT&T and Prairie Wave Telecommunications on the complaint, on the access charge complaint?
Yes, I have, and possibly in a roundabout way to address your concern. If you check our intervention, we are not contesting the rate or the request for the waiver for 2007. We've stated in our petition to intervene in TC07-118 as well as in TC 107-104 that if Prairie Wave were to amend its petition and request only a waiver for 1 year, we would withdraw our interventions.
All right. I have, based on that, I just wanted to clear that up, Mr. Chairman, and based on that, we have no objection to the intervention.
Does legal staff see any challenges to the semantics?
No, we do not.
Okay. Thank you. Then are there any questions from the commissioners? Seeing none, is there a motion?
I'd move to grant the intervention petition.
There is a motion. Any discussion? Commissioner Colbeck. calling on the vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying yes. Those opposed, please signify by saying no. Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes.
Commissioner Johnson.
Yes.
Commissioner Hansen votes yes. The motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an item under leadership, election of the vice chairperson of the commission. We held an election at our last meeting, as you'll recall, and not that we wish to act like a South American country, but we're going to have another election today at the request of Commissioner Johnson, who was elected to the vice chairmanship. And Commissioner Johnson, I'll turn the floor over to you.
Well, thanks, and I know this is probably eyebrow-raising, and so I apologize for any confusion, but after we had the last leadership election, there were some newspaper articles and some discussions talking about how this commission works pretty well together and that Commissioner Colbeck would, you know, eventually be, you know, worked into the leadership rotation. And it just seemed to me that this group does work very well together. I think I have tremendous respect for my colleagues, and I guess I don't know why we'd wait. I certainly have had as much power as I ever need to have, and I don't think the vice chair, I think Commissioner Colbeck will do a great job. I think he'll send a nice message. We do work well as a team, and I just think, Mr. Chairman, he'd be a great vice chair, and why wait? And with that, I would make a motion that we elect Steve Colbeck as the vice chair of the commission for the 2008 year.
Well said, and I appreciate very much, and as I'm sure Steve does too, the fact that you brought this up and were willing to do that. We attempt as best we can to act in a nonpartisan fashion. I've often made statements about how it's odd how we are elected, and I think it's very gracious of you to turn that over and to let Steve have that shot and to signify that we are very unified moving forward so that everyone is part of the rotation. With that,
it's not the pure altruism. He is washing my car every week for a year.
Do you wish to say anything in your defense, Mr. Commissioner Colbeck?
No, I've actually got to get going. I've got work to do. I learn more and more every day on this commission. I appreciate the two of you by my side every day and helping me gain knowledge, and I look forward to the challenges. Thank you.
I will say that if he demands I call him Mr. Vice Chairman, I will decline. So.
I may not want this job if he's not going to call me that.
All right. Well, we have a motion before us, and we've had more discussion than we needed. All those in favor of the motion, I guess, or opposed. Commissioner Colbeck, how do you vote?
Yes.
Commissioner Johnson?
Yes.
Hansen votes yes. The motion carries. Congratulations, Commissioner Johnson. And announcements. Next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held January 29 at 2, room 464, we believe. Commission meetings are scheduled for February 12 and 26. An open house for legislators was held in the commission offices this morning and all of this morning. Commission offices will be closed Monday, January 21st in observance of Martin Luther King Day. We hope all of you have a safe trip home. Means adjourned.